6422. Here on behalf of Ms. Fields is Mr. Benjamin. Here on behalf of the state is Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Benjamin, are you prepared to present argument?
I am, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. It's my great privilege to represent Catherine Fields in this matter. She was a victim of an unprovoked battery by off-duty police officers and others. When she acted in self-defense, she was taken to the ground, sat upon, and held down there by use of what was called the twisting arm control. She was then illegally arrested by the responding officers, handcuffed and held down. We asked the court to vacate the convictions and remand for a new trial because the jury should have been instructed that the police officers making an unlawful arrest or not acting in the performance of their duties. In order to be entitled to a jury instruction, such as the one requested by defense counsel, we have to show the four requirements in State v. Federley. First, of course, that the proposed instruction properly stated the governing law. There are two paragraphs in the proposed instruction. The first paragraph of the instruction is based on 19603 sub 6, which permits arrest in response to an assault or a battery when there's probable cause. Now, that was the correct statement of the law as we understood it at the time of the trial. But since the time of the trial, the state Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, has issued State v. Clark, which says that the officer cannot arrest for a misdemeanor which is not committed in his or her presence. So it's even clearer now under Clark that the arrest that was effectuated in this case was illegal because it was not committed in the presence of either of the officers who responded.
Mr. Benjamin, setting aside for a moment whether their initial contact with Ms. Fields was an arrest, when they arrived and they observed the altercation between Ms. Fields and Ms. Busta and Trombetta and the bar owner, wouldn't that have constituted observing a misdemeanor being committed in their presence?
Yes, but it was a misdemeanor being committed by Trombetta and the other people who were sitting on top of my client.
But doesn't the video also indicate that one of those two, I can't remember, either Busta or Trombetta, said, "She's clawing at me, she tried to bite me," and in fact they observed Ms. Fields flailing and attempting to strike people. Wouldn't that constitute observing at least an assault or an attempt at an assault?
You know, Your Honor, because the She is the victim of this crime. So she is not she's not committing a crime. She is a victim of the battery committed by the other people. There is probable cause to arrest Trombetta at this point, but there's no probable cause to arrest the innocent person who is being held on the sidewalk. A person has a right to use a reasonable amount of force to resist a crime being committed against them. And that's all the police knew at the time when they arrived.
Well, actually, when they arrived, what they knew is that there had been a call about essentially mutual combat, right? An ongoing physical altercation between Fields, Busta, Trombetta, and the bar owner.
Well, it's unclear from the testimony what the call was to the police. The 911 call is never introduced into the case. They say they respond to a call about a fight, but who is the aggressor and who is the victim is unclear.
But isn't that enough to invoke the sort of community caretaking function to detain parties?
It's certainly enough for the police to arrive and separate the parties and assist Ms. Fields, who is sitting on the ground now, and find out what happens. Yes. There's no doubt about that. What there's not sufficient evidence to prove to do is to sit on top of her and handcuff her and hold her to the ground, which is what exactly what happened in this case.
Thank you.
So to the second paragraph in the instruction, turning back to the first federally requirement, that is also a correct statement of the law, because a peace officer making an unlawful arrest is not acting in the performance of his or her duty. We know this because the legislature has made it a misdemeanor crime to make an illegal arrest. An officer who makes an illegal arrest is guilty of a misdemeanor. Thus, we have a legislative determination that illegal arrest is not part of an official duty. Now, the state says if your initial contact is somehow lawful, you can go off on sort of a frolic and detour and commit what we believe was a misdemeanor on the part of the police officers, and somehow that is still part of your official duties. Now, the citations to the cases by the state don't support that. Don't support that proposition, as I set out in my reply brief. But let me take an example from recent events.
So, Mr. Benjamin, just so I'm clear, am I correct in understanding that it is your position that the officers could, under in performance of their duties, respond to the call and detain the parties to determine what was going on?
Yes, but they can't, they don't have the authority to handcuff my client and to restrain her on the ground. That's an arrest without probable cause and without it being committed in the presence of the officers. Now, had they handcuffed Trombetta, that would be something entirely different, because
so it
was battered.
Is it putting the handcuffs on your client that transforms it into an arrest?
That is one aspect. It's a totality of the circumstances analysis, as are many of these cases. Now, remember, let's take a step back. I'm only asking for a jury instruction. I'm not asking for a directed verdict or anything like that. So we only have to present some evidence that supports our theory of the case. So there is some evidence that Ms. Fields was under arrest at the time she was handcuffed and held to the ground. I think
is that a legal determination?
It is not a legal determination, because it's an element of the crime. The performance of duty has to be, it's one of the elements that the jury has to find. Now, if you go back and remember the Sixth Amendment cases that Justice Scalia, started, it's important that the jury determine every element of the crime. In Nieder versus United States is one of those important cases. And in Nieder, one of the elements of the crime was whether the false statement was material. And for years and years and years in federal court, it was thought that materiality was a question of law. And the federal court, the federal judges routinely decided for the jury whether or not materiality was a question of law. Now, Nieder, in Justice Scalia's Sixth Amendment jurisprudence, says that doesn't matter. The jury gets to determine even something that looks like a legal question, performance of public duties, because it's an element of the offense.
So are you equating whether she was detained or arrested with the term performance of duty?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If my proposition is if the arrest was illegal, then that is not in the performance of public duty. And I draw that from the legislation that says a police officer can't do that or they're guilty of a misdemeanor. For an example, if the officer in Minnesota, Derek Chavin, he was acting in the performance of his lawful duty when he spoke to Mr. Floyd about the allegation of a forgery. That's in the performance of a lawful duty. He was no longer acting in the performance of a lawful duty when he held Mr. Floyd down to the ground with his knee for 9 minutes. So the fact that you start.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding. So are you defining performance of their duty sort of at a discrete period? So there's this continuum, and at any particular time, we look and see if they're performing their duties. Or since you agreed that it was in their performance of their duties to respond to the call, are you suggesting the court would not read it that broadly and say initially they were within the performance of their duty, and that sort of investigation ends and we only look at a discrete period of time? Do you understand my question?
I do, Your Honor, and don't apologize for interrupting me with questions. It's the only reason I'm here. Let's use an example of a female motorist who is stopped, who is broken down on the side of the road late at night in a deserted county here in our state. And a police officer comes up and says, "What's happened?" And she says, "Well, I've run out of gas. Can you give me a ride to the gas station?" This is all in the performance of lawful duty. What's not in the performance of lawful duty is if he takes that woman into the car and sexually assaults her. That is no longer the performance of a lawful duty, even if it began that performance. And even if he later, after he is done assaulting her, even if he continues on and takes her to the gas station, that is not the performance of lawful duty.
But let's say in your scenario, of course, it begins as a performance of a lawful duty. And during the course of that, of their conversation, she admits that she's been using drugs and possesses drugs, and he then pats her down and arrests her for possession of a controlled substance. Is he no longer in the performance of his duties when he begins to ask her about these controlled substances?
Well, I think that he is, but I don't see how that's relevant to this case, because if an officer substitutes one lawful duty for another lawful duty, I think that's totally appropriate. What's not appropriate is when the officer starts to commit something illegal. If you're legally searching a house and then you decide you're going to steal something from the house, that theft is not a performance of your lawful duty. And a person can grab that out of the officer's hand and say, "Hold on, you don't have a search warrant for my jewelry. You only have a search warrant to look at my cell phone." So
here they arrive and there is this physical altercation that they observe, and they attempt to detain or separate everybody. And I understand that the issue is about when Ms. Fields becomes arrested. And in the course of separating her, although she's in handcuffs, she then becomes combative with the officers, right?
Well,
and so unless placing her in the handcuffs is the moment she becomes arrested, I'm trying to understand at what point the illegal police conduct occurs.
Well, when she's handcuffed and held down to the ground by the police officer. And by the way, Your Honor, I don't think the evidence supports the idea that they tried to separate these people at all. It was more of a mob of people, off-duty police officers and the owner of the bar mobbing up with the assistance of the police against my client. I think that's more what the evidence shows. But the point I'm trying to make is that this is not something that needs to be decided between lawyers or by judges. This is a jury question. This is a question of whether or not the state has proven every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And one of those elements is that they were acting in the performance of lawful duty. And the jury was entitled, my client was entitled to a instruction, allowing, giving its theory of the case, giving her theory of the case about why this wasn't a performance of lawful duty. So we can disagree. If we were on the jury, we might all come to the decision that the police officers were acting in the performance of legal duty. My point is only that the jury gets to decide that. And the jury did not get to decide that in this case because they weren't properly instructed. So to continue my illustration about Mr.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. Let me interrupt you first.
Sure.
The performance of lawful duty, there's a lot of discussion in your brief, particularly at page 13, about the least intrusive method, and a lot of discussion about, well, the officers could have done this, or the officers could have done that, or the officers could have done one thing or another, and it would have been least intrusive method in the course of the investigation. None of which was discussed by counsel below ever, and none of which was the subject of cross-examination by counsel ever. And wouldn't, in order to be properly instructed, as opposed to the instruction proposed, wouldn't there have to be a whole host of instructions regarding detention, arrest, de facto arrest, and what the elements of de facto arrest are, even if it's a proper jury instruction question, and I'm not conceding that. But this instruction doesn't go anywhere near any of that. And that was, in essence, the objection of the prosecutor at the time. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I have two responses. One, that the trial counsel said, look, if you don't think my instruction covers everything, I'm happy to hear your other instructions. And if
he said was, I'm happy to add more language from the statute. Yeah. I'm reading it right now.
Well, I paraphrase.
That's what he said. I'm happy to add more language from the statute, but I don't think it's relevant.
Yeah.
That's what he said. That's the extent of his response to the prosecutor's arguments in this case.
And that's what he says. He says what he says, Your Honor, and I have the record that I have. Now, that doesn't mean that the judge can't say, I agree, we need to instruct on this element of the crime, but in order to make that fair, we need to take into consideration what the state has to say. Now, we never got to that point because the judge says, I'm not giving it. If the judge says, this is an appropriate instruction and I'm going to give it, but we need other instructions, well, that's all fine and well. But we never even get to that point because
the judge expressly allowed twice at the end of the instructions conference the opportunity for, at the time of finalization of the instructions, the opportunity for counsel to again address the issue, and counsel refused to do so. So I don't know how submitting an instruction that goes halfway or partway then puts the onus on, oh, well, that goes halfway or partway, so that's fine. And then somebody, the judge or the prosecutor, has to go the rest of the way. I don't understand that argument at all.
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly the onus that you put on defense counsel every day of the week. Now, the jury instructions as currently constituted go part of the way. They instruct partly on what the jury's duty is and partly on what the information is. Now, it's defense counsel's duty to say, hey, wait a second, I think we need more. And if the state thinks we need more after the defense gets its jury instruction, well, the onus is on the state, not on the defense, to propose the state's jury instructions. Now, remember, my recollection is, and you have it in front of you, and I don't, my recollection is the judge says, I'm not giving this instruction because I don't think it's appropriate under the relevant, really irrelevant case law. So no amount of further argument is going to make any difference to the judge. So I think the issue was perfectly well preserved. It wasn't a matter of the additional evidence that was put on somehow made made defining an element of the crime more or less important. Trial counsel didn't have anything more to add based on the judge's ruling that he wasn't going to give it because he didn't think it was a correct statement of law. My time is up, but I'm happy to answer any other questions.
I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Benjamin.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jorgensen, the state's response.
Thank you. May it please the court. Before getting on my argument, I'd like to address a couple of things. First off, I would submit that not in the presence issue, the legality of the arrest based upon the presence of the officers or the crime committed is actually not before this court. It's not in the proposed jury instruction. At no time did the defense request any sort of instruction that said that an arrest based upon anything other than a lack of probable cause would take it outside the duties of the officer. Second, I think it's important here that my
friend... Hang on a second, Mr. Jorgensen. That's essentially the Clark issue, right? And so...
Correct.
Your assertion is we could not apply Clark even though it's hadn't been decided at the time of the trial because it wasn't requested?
My assertion is that the instruction at issue doesn't say anything about the Clark issue. It does not say anything about being in the presence. It says only about probable cause. So there was never a request for a Clark-based instruction, an instruction that said an arrest is illegal if it's for a misdemeanor that happens outside the presence of the officer. The only instruction only
talks. It's your position that we could not apply Clark on appeal?
No, it's my position that the Clark issue was never raised.
Okay.
The proposed jury instruction is limited to the lack of probable cause. It does not present in the proposed jury instruction any sort of Clark issue or any sort of request that the presence of the officers at the time of the misdemeanor would be a basis for finding any sort of illegality. Second off, counsel has repeatedly referred to an official duty, a lawful duty, or a legal duty, but that appears nowhere in the statute. And I think that that's important. The statute and the charge actually says while the officers are, quote, engaged in the performance of his duties. So there's nothing in the statutory language that includes languages of official, lawful, or illegal. Those are in other parts of the statute. And so clearly there's an attempt to engraft phrases like official, lawful, or legal onto the duties when none appears in the statute. There simply is none. And that's part of the state's argument here about an arrest, even if unsupported by probable cause, is still part of an officer's duties. That there may be other issues and there may be other remedies, but it doesn't take the arrest itself outside the scope of the duties. Another flaw of the statute is that it assumes that the arrest is the only duty involved here, when clearly there are many other duties. The third officer assaulted at the jail had nothing whatsoever to do with the arrest. So the whole idea that he's not carrying out his duty because a different officer at a different time prior to the battery did not have probable cause for the arrest, therefore the jailer isn't involved in his official duties, is really quite a stretch. So that makes the instruction erroneous and confusing in that it narrows all of the duties of all of the victim officers to the one incident of handcuffing that preceded all of the batteries.
So, Mr. Jorgensen, just are you suggesting that there is no implicit requirement that the duties be official or lawful or otherwise legal? Or are you simply arguing that regardless of whether the arrest was legal, that the arrest is part of the official duty?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay.
In essence, the statute doesn't incorporate any sort of language indicating that the duty has to be lawfully performed. It only has to be a duty of the officer. Arrest is clearly a duty of the officer. The statute says nothing about whether that duty is or is not lawfully performed. In addition, the term duty, the word duty, as this court has said in Kent, is much more expansive than just the official arrest. It includes the investigation, it includes the transportation, it includes providing security at the jail, it includes all of these other things that the officers were clearly engaged in that had nothing whatsoever to do with the initial handcuffing. So both of those things are applicable in this case in terms of the scope of the duties and how that phrase should or shouldn't be defined to the jury. In essence, this instruction defined the duty of the officer involved in this case as only the arrest, and that just simply isn't the case. Kent tells us otherwise.
So you would read duty as, since it was part of the officer's official duty to respond to the 911 call, and that because that response was their duty, anything that occurred thereafter would fall within the statute, was in the performance of the officer's duty, regardless of the legality of that behavior.
Not necessarily, but what I am saying is that certain things that do happen during the course of that do not remove the action from in the performance of his duties. So the battery has to only be while. It's a temporal requirement. So it has to be while the officer is engaged in the performance of his duties. It isn't a requirement that it be in response to those duties. It isn't a requirement of any of those sorts of things. That's, again, in a different part of the statute. It only has to be while the officer is engaged. And I think that this distinguishes this case from the sort of hypotheticals proposed by counsel, such as a theft or a sexual assault, which are clearly outside the scope of the duties. And it would be my argument here that an officer engaged in a theft or a sexual assault is not also engaged in the performance of his duties. He's engaged in solely something outside of his duty. There is no contemporaneousness of that.
I think under the examples there were, right? I mean, in the female motorist on the side of the road, contemporaneous with whatever hypothetical activities occur, it occurs while the officer is engaged in the community caretaker function, which...
I would disagree, Your Honor, and I think that this is analogous to the situation of abandonment we find in the Fourth Amendment law. In other words, if an officer initiates an encounter based upon community caretaking with a motorist, but then engages in a sexual assault, he has completely abandoned any sort of communicating caretaking function at the time of the sexual assault. He's not simultaneously community caretaking and sexually assaulting.
But I think that's Mr. Benjamin's argument, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think if I understand it is, although the officer initially perhaps was engaged in investigation and community caretaker, that at the time he placed the handcuffs on Miss Fields, he'd abandoned that and engaged in otherwise illegal behavior. Because it seems to me this entire case boils down to, was the officer engaged in the performance of the duties at the time he handcuffs Miss Fields? If so, everything that happens thereafter is under the statute, and if not, potentially, everything that happens thereafter is not.
Well, I disagree that the only thing that the officer did was handcuff Mrs. Fields. In order to say that at the time of the kicking, which was after the handcuffing and after the formal arrest, that the officers are not engaged in the duties has to mean that either A, the only duty the officers performed was to handcuff Mrs. Fields, or it has to be that somehow that handcuffing taints all other performance of official duties. So I think this is best illustrated on the third battery against the jail officer, who obviously had nothing whatsoever to do with the initial arrest. You know, to say that that officer was not engaged in the official duties, or not official duties, but he wasn't engaged in the performance of his duties is really quite a statement. It essentially requires that he's not in the performance of his official duties based upon a prior illegality committed by a different officer at a prior time. And that is really an extravagant, in my opinion, statement of the law. It just simply is unsupported that that officer was not engaged in his duties.
So,
at the time of the battery.
If the jury instruction had been given, would it be your position that at best or at most it would have only applied to the first misdemeanor battery because the second and the third occurred after she was formally placed under arrest?
If it was given and if it were a correct statement of the law, it would at best occur to a battery that occurred while the officer was engaged in that particular action. In other words, again, the statute says while engaged in the performance of his duties. So if the duty in question, and there are many in this case, we know that due to Kelly. So if the battery had occurred while the initial unlawful arrest, and assuming that any sort of illegality takes that out of the duties of the officer, then it would have had to have been any battery that was performed, that was committed between the alleged illegality, the handcuffing, and the proper arrest for the initial battery. Let's keep in mind, even counsel has conceded that the battery committed on the officer was at least a misdemeanor committed in his presence and therefore an arrestable offense. Therefore, when the officers did tell Ms. Fields that she was under arrest, there is no illegality that taints that. That was a perfectly proper and legal arrest. Therefore, I fail to understand how the officers are not engaged in their duty, even if this were a correct statement of the law, when the batteries actually occurred, and against all three officers, because all three officers were battered, the evidence shows, after Ms. Fields was told that she was under arrest for the first striking of the officer.
But her first charge was the one that she received when they were putting her in the car, and it was after that battery that she was placed under arrest. And your position is, but that battery occurred in the presence of the officers, they absolutely could have placed her under arrest for it, and therefore there is no taint from the initial handcuffing. Because no battery occurred in the course of the initial handcuffing and taking her over to the police car.
Well, that's essentially correct. As I understand the sequence of events as demonstrated by the evidence, the officers arrived, they found the ensuing, you know, the ongoing melee outside of the bar. They did cuff Ms. Fields, and when they attempted to move her to the car, that's when she first struck out and kicked one of the officers. She was then under arrest. There were a series of batteries that followed that, on both of the officers present. And then once she got to the jail, there were additional batteries on the arresting officers and the jail personnel. And so the state didn't differentiate each individual strike. So at most, this instruction would have covered the initial kick. It would not have covered all of the kicks and strikes and fingernail gouging and the different activities that she engaged in after she was told she was under arrest. Because again, that arrest was based upon probable cause for a battery on an officer that happened in the presence. The only argument presented is that that was a misdemeanor battery, not a felony battery. However, the charge encompassed kicking and striking and other activities, both pre and post the formal arrest. And I think that this brings up another question about the adequacy of the instruction. The instruction was inadequate for a variety of reasons, even if it were a correct statement of law that an illegality attached to a specific action is taken outside the scope of the officer's duties. Again, there were many things that the officers did. The officers took many lawful actions. These batteries happened while the officers were taking these additional lawful actions. But even if we assume that it's that the original handcuffing is taken outside the scope of the duties, and even if we assume that the officers aren't engaged in their duties from the handcuffing to the formal arrest, this instruction is still incomplete in a variety of ways, because it doesn't address all of the duties that the officers included. And as Judge Gratton pointed out, it's incomplete even if proper. It doesn't define what probable cause is. It doesn't tell us what a de facto arrest is. It does not give the jury any meaningful basis to conclude whether this arrest was lawful, when it lawfully happened. And the district court did address that. It specifically said, look, according to the evidence, the officers testified that the arrest happened upon the formal announcement of arrest. The district court was very clearly aware of this problem in terms of trying to convince a jury that, no, the officers were wrong about that. Legally, the arrest happened at a different point. So the district court did believe that this instruction was inadequate based upon the evidence, and it would have required additional instruction to the jury in order to make it adequate under the evidence, even if it were a correct statement of the law, which, of course, it's not. And counsel's argued, well, we had no duty to fully instruct the jury or propose fully adequate instructions. A partially adequate instruction is enough. And no, that's not the law. The instructions have to adequately address the legal principle involved. And basically, this is a theory of the case instruction. You know, the whole idea that the defense can present a partially inadequate, partially misleading instruction, and they're entitled to it, but you know what, the state can present additional instructions that make it unmisleading or complete, just simply isn't the law. Either this instruction is an adequate statement of the law, or it is not, and it is not. In this particular case, the instruction provided, the district court correctly said it wasn't an accurate statement of the law. It was inapplicable under the facts of this case, and ultimately was properly not given. The state has also raised a harmless error argument, and the harmless error argument is very similar to the incompleteness of the instruction argument, which is the evidence did establish multiple batteries on both the two officers present on the street and on the jailer that happened after the admittedly lawful arrest for the initial battery. In other words, the only thing the jury properly instructed could have concluded was that the very first kicking of the officer was not a felony, was not within the course of the duty. Every single striking, every single use of force that she employed thereafter clearly was, because she was properly arrested for the initial battery. She was properly transported to the jail based upon that lawful arrest. And she chose to attack the officers while they were engaged in the performance of their duties, even if the initial handcuffing was somehow outside the scope of those duties. And for these reasons, the state would request that this court affirm the district court's ruling.
Mr. Jorgensen, I have a follow-up question on the jury instruction issue. And I'm not sure entirely how to articulate this. The district court has an independent obligation to correctly instruct the jury. And it seems to me that if the district court is placed on notice by either the defense or the prosecution, that there is an issue on which there needs to be a correct statement of the law. Regardless of what's proffered by the parties, doesn't the court have an independent obligation to correctly instruct the jury?
No, Your Honor. I believe that at one point in Idaho law, that was the case. However, the Supreme Court has disavowed that. In other words, it has concluded that there is no independent duty on a court to present a theory of the case, even if it's supported by the evidence, that it really is the defendant's duty to submit their own theory of the case. And then the court rules only on the adequacy of the proposed instruction. So,
But not on the theory of the case, on jury instructions in general. For example, even if neither party proffers a reasonable doubt instruction, the court can't simply declined to give a reasonable doubt instruction because it wasn't offered by one of the parties.
No, but if a party submits a reasonable doubt instruction, the court is required to rule on that particular instruction. If there is an independent duty to give a correct reasonable doubt instruction, the court still doesn't err by denying an incorrect reasonable doubt instruction.
Okay.
And therefore, the state does request that this court affirm the judgment of conviction.
Thank you. Mr. Benjamin, any reply?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. If I might respond to your question that was just posed, there is a statute that says the court has a duty to instruct on all matters necessary for the determination of the jury. So there is that. So I think a court has a duty to instruct on the elements of the offense, irrespective of the state even asking it to. So I think that's that. As to Mr. Jorgensen's or the state's arguments, first, I think that Clark clearly applies in the sense that it's retroactive, that it applies to all cases that are still pending on direct appeal, which this one is, that's Griffith versus Kentucky. The importance of Clark in this case is that it proves that the arrest for the battery that occurred outside the presence of the officers, that of Harvey, who the state dismisses that charge later, because there was no factual basis for it, and whatever assault there may have been against the bartender / deputy Trombetta, those didn't occur in the presence. There was no probable cause to arrest for them anyway, but Clark makes that even clearer, I think. Now, as to whether or not there were multiple other things that the officers did, I disagree with the state about that. They come in, they arrest Ms. Fields right away. They don't do any investigation whatsoever.
Well, I think to be precise, Mr. Benjamin, they handcuff her and then attempt to put her in the patrol car. And I understand that you're characterizing that as an arrest, but I think that's really one of the issues to determine, right?
Right. I agree. But it's my position that it was an arrest, and I think I've articulated that repeatedly. So I use shorthand to say that. They held her down and they handcuffed her for no reason whatsoever. They didn't move any of the spectators, people who were committing crimes, away. They just let a mob rule. And then they lift her up, not gently, I suspect, and try to move her to the police car. The fact that they're putting her in the police car shows that she's already under arrest, in my opinion. But the point is, Your Honor, is whether or not there were other duties that the officers were doing is a jury question. It is not for the lawyers and the judge to decide. It's for the jury to decide under the Sixth Amendment. We have a right to have the jury decide each and every element of the offense. One of the elements is performance of duty. Our theory of the case, and we're entitled to a theory of the case instruction under this court's cases, our theory of the case is that they were not performing their duty because they were committing a crime against Ms. Fields from the very inception of their first encounter with her. They were committing a crime against her, and everything flows from that. Each of the counts that occurs after that initial illegal arrest, in my opinion, and what I would argue to the jury, it all flows from that moment on. Now, I understand the state has other views of what happened, and they could certainly articulate that to the jury, but it is the jury that should have heard that argument, not this court.
So, Mr. Benjamin, what about the fact that after she is, perhaps, for shorthand purposes, I will say formally placed under arrest, when they articulated to her that she was under arrest because of the battery that then occurred in their presence, and then there's the third battery that she's convicted of for the jailer. Is it your position that those two batteries, despite occurring in their presence, are somehow invalidated by placing the handcuffs on her earlier?
I understand the court's concern with count three, and I understand where there might be a harmless error question as to that. But as to the applicability of the jury, the jury still gets to decide whether or not in count three the jailer was acting in performance of their duty.
So what about count two?
Count two is, I don't think there's any doubt about that. That was a continuation of the original illegal arrest. They were effectuating that illegal arrest when count two happened.
And so when they then say to her, articulate that she is under arrest, that in your, from your perspective, to the extent there was any earlier illegality when they handcuffed her, formally placing her under arrest for a crime that occurred in their presence at that point, does not, for lack of a better word, attenuate or cure what from your position is an earlier illegality.
No, I think whether they say you're under arrest or not has very little, if any, legal meaning, because it's she was already under arrest without being announced. We don't let the police decide by their discretion or their fiat when someone is arrested. It's the facts that determine the arrest, and the police are not performing their duty because they're effectuating that illegal arrest. That's my opinion, and I think that's what the jury should have been able to decide. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. The court appreciates the briefing and argument in this case. The case is now before the court. The court takes it under advisement and will issue an opinion in due course. We will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.